Chapter 3, Franklin D. Roosevelt. The crash of 1929 and the resulting depression have been exhaustively covered in a previous work, Secrets of the Federal Reserve, 1983. Roosevelt was elected president in 1932 in a campaign which ignored Hoover's Rothschild connections and his World War I record. Instead, Roosevelt blamed Hoover for a depression which had been set up by the Bank of England. Hoover states in his memoirs, "In replying to Roosevelt's statement that I was responsible for the orgy of speculation, I considered for some time whether I should expose the responsibility of the Federal Reserve Board by its deliberate inflation policies from 1925 to 28 under European influence, and my opposition to these policies." Hoover remained silent, and was ushered out of office. He later termed Gerard Swelp's economic planning for the New Deal as the precise pattern of fascism. The New Dealers, by an unofficial observer, Literary Guild 1934, noted that the New Deal included W.A. Harriman, administrator in charge of heavy industry, and his sister, Mary Rumsey, who backed Newsweek with Vincent Astor, and the New Deal Weekly, Today. Observer also noted that Colonel House was the elder statesman behind the New Deal, and that House had only backed two presidential candidates, Wilson and FDR. Roosevelt continued the Wilson policies, actually the House policies outlined in Philip Drew, administrator, with the same personnel, and ended as Wilson did, by involving America in another world war. Observer states that Colonel House's New York apartment was only two blocks from the Roosevelt home on E. 65th Street in New York, and that House was seen there almost every day in 1932. He also visited Roosevelt in New England and on the Roosevelt yacht. To consolidate Roosevelt's power, his backers used the typical world order scheme. They set up his opposition. In August 1934, the principal architects and financiers of his New Deal formed the Liberty League, immediately characterized as an extreme right-wing organization. Pierre and Ione DuPont put up $325,000 for it. The League was also financed by J.P. Morgan, the Rockefellers, J. Howard Pugh, and William J. Knudsen, who was later appointed by FDR to an important position. The backers of Liberty League, who were busily denouncing Roosevelt and his staff as communist, which many of them were also the organizers of American International Corporation, which had been formed to prevent the economy of the Soviet Union from collapsing. Liberty League successfully corralled the opponents of FDR and branded them as right-wing nuts. Roosevelt was given the opportunity to rant against his opposition as economic royalists, the old guard, and princes of privilege. Gerald L. K. Smith was then brought into the picture, in order to smear Roosevelt's opposition as anti-Semitic. The ploy operated from 1934 to the 1936 elections, when it effectively destroyed London's campaign. No effective political opposition was organized against Roosevelt for the rest of his lifetime in office. It was one of the most successful political hoaxes in American history. Roosevelt then married his son to an heiress of the DuPont dynasty. At the very time that Eugene DuPont, cousin of Pierre, was one of the most active members of the Liberty League, FD, Roosevelt Jr. was courting his daughter, Edith Hell. They were married June 28, 1937, in what Time magazine called the Wedding of the Year, presided over by Dr. Endicott Peabody. The couple made the cover of Time magazine, the only newlyweds ever to do so. These measures were necessary because FDR's backers were planning to involve the U.S. in the Second World War. Any popular political opposition to Roosevelt might have swept him out of office in 1940. Just when he was needed to bring off the Pearl Harbor attack. On the morning of Pearl Harbor, General Marshall, his chief of staff, met secretly with Maxima Litvinov, married to Ivy Lowe of England, to assure the Russians that everything was going according to plan. Marshall later testified before Congress that he couldn't remember where he was on Pearl Harbor Day. The managed conflict was well on its way. Jacques Rueffer points out that Schack did not invent Hitler's monetary policy, it was imposed on Germany by American and British creditors to finance war preparations and finally unleash war itself, the monetary sins of the West. Rueffer also points out that the Standstill Agreement of 1931, allowing Germany a moratorium on war debts through the 1930s, was an amicable pact between the London, New York and German branches of the Warburg and Schroeder houses. Max Warburg remained Schacht's deputy at the Reichsbank until 1938. Kurt von Schroeder then became his deputy. Schacht's father had been Berlin agent for the Equitable Life Insurance Company of New York. The industrialist levies for Hitler, the Circle of Friends, were paid into the Schroeder Bank. Throughout the 1930s, Hitler was duped into persevering in his desire for friendship with England, an alliance originally proposed jointly by Theodore Roosevelt and the Kaiser in 1898 between the three Nordic powers, England, Germany and the United States. The SCHUDs assured Hitler that their Anglo-German fellowship in England was 100 times more influential than it actually was. With such figures as the Astors and the Chamberlains supporting rapport with Germany, Hitler was persuaded that war with England was impossible. In 1933 he had announced his discovery that Marx, Lenin and Stalin had all said that before international communism could triumph, England and her empire must be destroyed. "I am willing to help defend the British Empire by force if called upon," he declared. In 1936, Hitler arranged for meetings to take place between English and German diplomats, but the desired result was never attained, as the British had only one goal: to lull Hitler into a sense of false security until they could declare war against him. To lure Hitler into World War II, it was necessary to guarantee him adequate supplies of such necessities as ball bearings and oil. Jacob Wallenberg of the Swedish Enskilda Bank, which controlled the giant SKF ball bearing plant, furnished ball bearings to the Nazis throughout the war. The anti-aircraft guns sending flak against American air crews turned on SKF ball bearings. Its American plant, SKF of Philadelphia, was repeatedly put on the proclaimed list, and each time, Dean Akeson removed it. President William S. Farish of Standard Oil refueled Nazi ships and submarines through stations in Spain and Latin America. When Queen Elizabeth recently came to the U.S., the only family she visited was the Farishes. Throughout the war, the British paid royalty to Ethel Standard Corporation on the gasoline used by German bombers who were destroying London. The money was placed in Farben bank accounts until after the war. I.G. Farben was organized by the Warburgs in 1925 as a merger between 6 giant German chemical companies: Badischer Anilin, Bayer, Agfa, Hoechst, Wolitemir, and Griesheim Electron. Max Warburg was director of IG Farben, Germany, and IG Chemie, Switzerland. American IG Farben was controlled by his brother, Paul, architect of the Federal Reserve System, Walter Teagle of Standard Oil, and Charles Mitchell of National City Bank. Just before World War II broke out, Ethel Standard shipped 500 tons of ethyl lead to the Reich Air Ministry through IG Farben, with payment secured by letter of Brown Brothers Harriman dated September 21, 1938. Throughout World War II, the Paris branches of J.P. Morgan and Chase National Bank continued to do business as usual. At the end of the war, occupation authorities repeatedly issued orders to dismantle IG Farben plants, but were countermanded by General William Draper of Dillon Reed, which had financed German rearmament in the 1920s. Winston Churchill remarked of this managed conflict in 1945, just before it ended, "There never was a war more easy to stop." Quoted in Washington Post June 11, 1984. The only real difficulty had been encountered in getting it started. Churchill succeeded in prolonging the war for at least a year by defeating General Wedemeyer's plan for a channel crossing in 1943, and by embarking on his ruinous North African-Sicilian swing, a replay of his disastrous Gallipoli campaign of the First World War. Life revealed April 9, 1951 that Eisenhower had radioed Stalin through the U.S. military mission in Moscow of his plan to stop at the Elbe and allow the Russians to take Berlin. The message had been written by Ike's political advisor, John Wheeler Bennett of RIA, received by W. Averill Harriman, and delivered to Stalin. In Washington, General Marshall assured President Truman that we were obligated to allow the Russians to take Berlin. Senator Joseph McCarthy later called Marshall a living lie. The conquered German people were now systematically looted and ruthlessly governed by the occupying powers. Henry Kissinger, John J. McCloy, son-in-law of a J.P. Morgan partner, Benjamin Button Weiser, partner of Kuhn, Loeb and Company. His wife was Alger Hiss's lawyer at his trial for perjury, and other Rothschild operatives descended like locusts upon the prostrate nation. Aid to Soviet Russia continued under the guise of the Marshall Plan, a rerun of Hoover's Belgian Relief Commission in World War I. The Marshall Plan originated as a special study by David Rockefeller for the Council on Foreign Relations, Reconstruction of Western Europe, completed in 1947. It was retitled the Marshall Plan and advertised as a great contribution to democracy in Europe. Imperial Brain Trust Shoop. W. Averill Harriman was installed in the Rothschild's Paris mansion, Hotel Talleyrand, as head of the Marshall Plan. The victorious Rothschilds consolidated their control of world monetary systems by the Bretton Woods Pact, a replica of the Charter of the Bank of England. It provided immunity from the judicial process, its archives were inviolable and not subject to court or congressional inspection, no taxation could be levied on any security, dividend or interest of the fund, all officers and personnel were immune from legal processes. The pact systematically looted Western Europe and the United States. On April 3, 1984, AP reported that British investments in the U.S. were now $115 billion, and the British held $28 billion in U.S. bank assets. At least one U.S. senator is a member of the British aristocracy, Malcolm Wallop, R. Wyoming, son of Honorable Oliver Wallop, whose brother is Earl of Portsmouth, created 1743. Senator Wallop's sister, Lady Porchester, married Lord Porchester, son of the Earl of Carnarvon. Lord Porchester is the Queen's Master of Horse, and her racing manager. Lord Carrington, for many years British Foreign Minister, is now Henry Kissinger's partner in Kissinger Associates, and was recently appointed head of NATO. He is chum of G. Chum, Australian New Zealand Bank, director of Rio Tinto, Barclays Bank, Cadbury Schweppes, Amalgamated Metal, British Metal, and Hambros Bank. His mother was the daughter of Viscount Colville, who was Financial Secretary of the Treasury 1936-38. Richard Davis notes in the English Rothschilds that Lionel Rothschild was a frequent visitor at Lord Carrington's house in Whitehall. In fact, Lord Carrington was related to the Rothschild family by marriage. The first Lord Carrington was Archibald Primrose. His son became Viscount Rosebery. The fifth Earl Rosebery married Hannah Rothschild, daughter of Meyer, in 1878. She was given away by Disraeli. World War II delivered the peoples of the world into the hands of the world order, with the predictable result that they have been systematically despoiled, terrorized, oppressed and massacred in further managed conflicts, not the least of which was the Vietnam War, in which American boys with little or no combat training were sent into battle against the highly trained guerrilla troops of Ho Chi Minh and General Giap, communist troops whose leaders had been intensively trained by the Special Austere Team. The Rothschilds rule the U.S. through their foundations, the Council on Foreign Relations, and the Federal Reserve System, with no serious challenges to their power. Expensive political campaigns are routinely conducted, with carefully screened candidates who are pledged to the program of the world order. Should they deviate from the program, they would have an accident, be framed on a sex charge, or indicted on some financial irregularity. Senator Moynihan stated in his book, Loyalties, a British friend, wise in the ways of the world, put it thus, they are now on page 16 of the plan. Moynihan prudently did not ask what page 17 would bring. The American citizen works hard and pays taxes, blissfully unaware that at any moment the secret rulers, operating through the Federal Reserve Board, can make a monetary ruling which will place him in onerous debt or bankrupt him. Gary Allen writes in American Opinion, October 7, 1979, whatever the future holds, you can bet it will be unstable with wide swings in the value of the dollar and precious metals. As long as Volcker's sponsors know in advance what his policies will be, they will make big money. This accurate prediction was followed by 20% interest and 25% inflation. Business Week, February 20, 1984, stated, the worst market for traders is a stable one. Investment banks now have a greater than ever vested interest in market instability. They can rack up enormous profits by guessing right about rapid, wide swings in profits, prices and interest rates. It is obvious that they can rack up enormous profits if they know in advance what the monetary decisions will be. Anyone who seriously believes that no one knows in advance what Federal Reserve decisions will be is too naive to be allowed out on their own. Anybody who believes that there is no one who can tell the Federal Reserve Board what its policies are to be is even more out of touch with reality. Many people believed that Lord Montague Norman ran the Bank of England as a one-man show for 30 years, showing that some people will believe anything. A. Craig Kopetters writes in Harper's, January 1984, How the Barbarians Do Business. About the 2,000 dealers of the London Metal Exchange, that viewing these people objectively, you are left with a simple scrap merchant, a rag and bone man, as the British call their junk dealers. It is the rag and bone men who are running the economies of the world up and down like a window shade, and profiting handsomely on every move of the markets. Carter Field notes in his biography of Baruch, Baruch got out of the market just before the crash. But what made Baruch sell stocks and buy tax exempts at such a favorable time? Field offers no answer. Norman Dodd, who was then with Bankers Trust, states that Henry Magenta came into Bankers Trust a few days before the crash, and ordered the officers to close out all securities of his trusts, $60 million, in 3 days. The officers tried to remonstrate with him, pointing out that if he would sell them over a period of weeks, he would make much greater profits, perhaps $5 million more than if they were disposed of on such short notice. Magenta became furious, screaming at them, I didn't come here to argue with you. Do as I say. Black Friday occurred within the week. On May 30, 1936, Newsweek wrote about a Roosevelt appointee to the Federal Reserve Board, Ralph W. Morrison. He sold his Texas utility stock to Insull for $10 million, and in 1929 called a meeting and ordered his banks to close out all security loans by September 1. As a result, they rode through the Depression with flying colors. The insiders come through with flying colors, while millions of victims are ruined, destroyed by forces which they refuse to believe exist. Heartbreak, losses of homes and businesses, breakdowns, suicides, destruction of families, these are the results of world order economic policies initiated and carried out by the rag and bone men. Through its monetary command to the Federal Reserve Board, the world order determines the outcome of American elections. A news commentator recently pointed out that Paul Volcker would determine whether Reagan would be re-elected. In 1980, the Federal Reserve Board deliberately defeated Carter and elected Reagan. Otto Eckstein noted in U.S. News, September 5, 1983, that the prime rate reached 21.5% in late 1980, creating a recession in an election year. Eckstein, head of data resources in Lexington, Mass. He later died suddenly, said, the Federal Reserve had never before made such a move. Only the world order knows whether the Federal Reserve will ride Reagan back into office in 1984 on a high tide of prosperity, or throw him out as the new Herbert Hoover. The more likely prospect is that he will be the Herbert Hoover of 1986 or 1988. One critic pointed out that Volcker has boosted interest rates, which hurts U.S. stocks, making short-term U.S. money instruments more desirable than long-term, and bringing about the very instability of foreign capital flows which he claims to fear. Gordon Thever writes in the London Financial Times, in all history, there can be fewer instances of a man having inflicted greater damage on the interests of his fellow human beings than Volcker has done with benign neglect and its all too many malignant manifestations, not the first of which is the ill-conceived gold demonetization campaign Washington has been engaged in since the late 60s. Interest rates rise when gold does not back currency. Through the London Gold Pool, the Federal Reserve System and the U.S. Treasury disposed of American gold at the giveaway price of $35 an ounce, one-tenth of its current value, robbing the American public of billions of dollars. On July 24, 1969, Volcker authorized SDR paper gold, special drawing rights, to replace gold in foreign exchange. He then triumphantly remarked to his fellow bankers in Paris, "Well, we got this thing launched." Secretary of the Treasury Connolly then took the Nixon administration off gold, devaluing the dollar in August 1971. On July 17, 1984, Jack Anderson described the Federal Open Market Committee in the Washington Post as a mysterious council of 12, the enigmatic group with excessive secrecy who, says Anderson, influence what rates you will pay, how much money will be available for business to borrow and whether inflation once again will eat up your earnings and reduce the value of your bank accounts. Despite the far-reaching importance of Volcker's decisions, his testimony before Congress is shrouded in gobbledygook. This writer has gone through hundreds of pages of his testimony without finding a single quotable phrase about his economic intentions. On July 9, 1984, Jack Anderson said of Volcker's meetings with high Treasury officials, one of them asked if he could recall anything Volcker had said during the high-level meetings, thought a moment and replied, "I can't remember anything he said that I understood." Senator Moynihan noted in the New Republic, December 31, 1983, the Fed does not control the precise money supply and cannot precisely determine interest rates. But it can set the direction and range for both, and this it did. Anyone who tried to dissent was soundly rapped. It's to dozen or so central bankers decided to bust the economy, and bust it they did. Paul Craig Roberts writes in Business Week, February 27, 1984, whatever Volcker's intentions, the empirical data show that there has been a deceleration in money growth since last spring and that the Fed has been using open market operations to keep interest rates up. What concerns the financial markets is the eclipse of Reagan's policies by Volcker's. The most likely result will be higher taxes and higher deficits. Nevertheless, the press and the Democrats attack Reagan as responsible for the deficit, over which he has no control, and which Volcker creates. The New York Times stated that whoever won the election in November 1984, it has already been decided that taxes will be increased by $100 billion. Here again, why have an election of elected officials who have no influence in economic affairs? Brunner recently interviewed Walter Wriston, retired head of Citibank, who said, "I have been through the Fed's actions for the past 15 years in detail. The Fed has exercised a malign influence on the economy of this country. Its interference in the financial markets of America over the last decade has resulted in persistently excessive money growth, inflation which undermined the financial strength of U.S. corporations owing to the combined inflation and excessive rates of taxation, and record debt. Forbes pointed out June 20, 1983, in a story about Tony Solomon, "Solomon may be the most important man in the Federal Reserve System after the chairman, and what he says and does has an effect upon us all." Perhaps you have never heard of Tony Solomon. Certainly you have never voted him into any office, yet what he says and does has an effect upon us all. He is the chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, a post formerly held by Paul Volcker. This bank represents the New York money market in the Federal Reserve System. 53% of its stock is held by five New York banks whose controlling influence is the London House of Rothschild. The chairman of the FRBNY sits permanently on the FOMC at the right hand of the chairman of the Board of Governors. Sections 12A of the 1913 Federal Reserve Act provided that five representatives of the 12 Federal Reserve banks should rotate on the FOMC. This was quietly amended in August 1943, while World War II was raging, to read, "One elected annually by the Board of Directors of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York," replacing the provision that one should be elected annually by the Boards of Directors of the Federal Reserve Banks of Boston and New York. FRBNY is now the only Federal Reserve Bank with a permanent seat on the FOMC. The American public was never informed of this change. Chapter 4, The Buisness of America, Part 1. John Moody, author of many standard reference works on American finance, stated in McClure's Magazine, August 1911, "The seven men in Wall Street now control a great share of the fundamental industry and resources of the United States. Three of the seven men, J.P. Morgan, James Stillman, and George F. Baker, head of the First National Bank of New York, belong to the so-called Morgan Group, four of them, John D. and William Rockefeller, James Stillman, head of the National City Bank, and Jacob H. Siff of the private banking firm of Kuhn, Loeb Company to the so-called Standard Oil National City Bank Group. The central machine of capital extends its control over the U.S. The process is not only economically logical, it is now practically automatic. What was true in 1911 is even more true in 1984. The seven men are now, as then, merely American agents for London interests." In 1919, Moody wrote in Masters of Capital, "All of the great bankers began as dry goods traders, including Junius S. Morgan. B.B. Morgan was a dry goods house. J.M. B.B. Company of Boston made Junius S. Morgan a partner. Junius Morgan was later invited to join George Peabody and Company of London, which handled most of the House of Rothschild's trading in American stocks. Junius Morgan's son, J.P. Morgan, later changed the name of the firm to J.P. Morgan and Company, but it continued to one of three representatives of the House of Rothschild in the U.S., the others being Kuhn, Loeb & Company and August Belmont. The Morgan Group and the National City Bank Group held a secret meeting at Jekyll Island, Gar. The week of November 22, 1910 to consolidate their financial power. Present were Senator Nelson Aldrich, his daughter married John D. Rockefeller Jr., his private secretary, Shelton A. Piatt Andrews, asked. Seconds of the Treasury, Frank Vanderlip, President National City Bank, Henry P. Davison, J.P. Morgan's right-hand man, Charles D. Norton, President First National Bank of New York, Benjamin Strong of Liberty National Bank. He later married the daughter of the President of Bankers Trust, became President of Bankers Trust, and Chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and Paul Warburg, a German immigrant who had joined Kuhn, Loeb & Company. Although these men were the most influential financiers in the U.S., they were present at Jekyll Island merely as the emissaries of Baron Alfred Rothschild, who had commissioned them to prepare legislation establishing a central bank in the U.S., modeled on the European fractional reserve central banking organizations of the Reichsbank, the Bank of England, and the Bank of France, all of which were controlled by the House of Rothschild. To enact the Federal Reserve Act into the law of the land, the bankers elected Woodrow Wilson president of the U.S. In 1912, by splitting the Republican Party, defeating the popular William Howard Taft by financing Theodore Roosevelt's malicious Bull Moose third-party candidacy. Wilson's academic career at Princeton had been financed by gifts from Cleveland H. Dodge, director of National City Bank, and Moses Taylor Bine, grandson and heir of the founder of National City Bank. Wilson then signed an agreement not to go to any other college. The Federal Reserve Act was legislated through Congress as the Glass-Owen Bill, backed by two Democrats, Congressman Carter Glass of Virginia, and Senator Robert Owen of Oklahoma. Owen was persuaded to back the bill by Samuel Untermeyer, who had cultivated him while acting as counsel for the Bujo Money Trust investigation. Untermeyer flattered Owen by entertaining him at Greystone, his palatial Hudson River estate. Untermeyer claimed to be a progressive Democrat, although he lived in feudal splendor, employing 167 men to tend his expanse of orchids and greenhouses. At Greystone, Owen dined with Paul Warburg, Bernard Baruch, and other financiers who had been instructed to get the Federal Reserve Act passed. Owen, a former Indian agent who knew little about finance, was easily persuaded by Paul Warburg's doctrinaire pronunciamentos about our antiquated banking system, which must be brought up to par with the more modern banking system of Europe. After the Federal Reserve Act had been passed by Congress and signed into law by President Woodrow Wilson, six New York banks controlled by the Morgan Standard Oil Group bought controlling interest of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, which they have held ever since. The May 19, 1914 organization chart of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York shows that of the 203,053 shares issued, National City Bank took 30,000 shares, the Morgan Baker First National Bank took 15,000 shares. These two banks merged into the present Citibank in 1955, giving them one-fourth of the shares in the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. The $134 billion Citicorp is now the largest bank in the U.S. The National Bank of Commerce, of which Paul Warburg was a large shareholder, took 21,000 shares. Hanover Bank, now manufacturers Hanover, of which Lord Rothschild is a director, took 10,200 shares. Chase National Bank took 6,000 shares. Chemical Bank took 6,000 shares. These six banks in 1914 owned 40% of the stock of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. The Federal Reserve System printout of shareholders July 26, 1983 showed that they now own 53%, as follows: Citibank 15%, Chase Manhattan 14%, Morgan Guaranty Trust 9%, Manufacturers Hanover 7%, Chemical Bank 8%. Citicorp Citibank is No. 1 in size in the U.S. No. 3 is Chase Manhattan with $82 billion assets. No. 4 is Manufacturers Hanover, $64 billion. No. 5 is J.P. Morgan, $58 billion. No. 6 Chemical Bank. No. 11 is First Chicago, formerly First National Bank of Chicago, controlled by the Baker Morgan interests. House Rep. 159362, B.183, notes, next to Baker and Son, Morgan & Company is the largest stockholder of First National, of New York, owning 14,500 shares. Baker and Morgan together own 40,000 of the 100,000 shares of First National Bank. The New York Times, September 3, 1914, at the time of the Federal Reserve stock was being sold, showed the principal stockholders of these banks as follows: National City Bank, 250,000 shares, of which James Stillman owned 47,498, J.P. Morgan & Company 14,500, W. Rockefeller 10,000, M.T. Pine 8267, Percy Pine 8267, J.D. Rockefeller 1750, J.S. Rockefeller 100, W.A. Rockefeller 10, J.P. Morgan Jr. 1000. National Bank of Commerce, 250,000 shares, George F. Baker 10,000, J.P. Morgan Company 7,800, Mary W. Harriman, Widow E.H. 5,650, Paul Warburg 3,000, Jacob Siff 1,000, J.P. Morgan Jr. 1,100, Chase Natl. Bank, George F. Baker 13,408. Hanover Natal. Bank, James Stillman 4,000. William Rockefeller 1,540. During a period when thousands of U.S. banks have gone bankrupt since 1914, these banks, protected by their interest in the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, have grown steadily. A Senate report, Interlocking Directorates Among the Major U.S. Corporations, a staff study of the Senate Committee on Governmental Affairs, June 15, 1978, shows that five of these aforementioned banks held a total of 470 interlocking directorates in the 130 major corporations of the U.S., an average of 3.6 directors per major U.S. corporation. This massive report is worthy of anyone's detailed study. We can only give the totals here. Citicorp 97 directorates, J.P. Morgan Company 99 directorates, Chemical Bank 96 directorates, Chase Manhattan 89 directorates, Manufacturers Hanover 89 directorates, total 470. This centralized control over American industry by five New York banks controlled from London suggests that instead of 130 major U.S. corporations, we may have only one, which in itself is an outpost of the London connection. In the early 19th century, the House of Rothschild established a number of affiliates in the U.S., which carried the code identification of city banks, or city companies, identifying them as originating in the financial center, the City of London. The City Bank was established in New York in 1812, in the same room in which the Bank of the United States had operated until its charter expired. Later called the National City Bank, its principal for 50 years was Moses Taylor, whose father had been a confidential agent for John Jacob Astor and British intelligence. Like the Morgan Peabody operation, Moses Taylor doubled his fortune in the panic of 1837 by purchasing stock in the depressed market with capital advanced by N.M. Rothschild of London. During the panic of 1857, while many of its competitors failed, Citibank prospered. Moses Taylor purchased the outstanding stock of Delaware Lackawanna Railroad for $5 a share during the panic. 7 years later, it was worth $240 a share. He was now worth $50 million. His son-in-law, Percy Pine, had come from London to work at Citibank, and married Taylor's daughter. When Taylor died in 1882, he left $70 million. His son-in-law, now paralyzed, became president of the now National City Bank. John D. Rockefeller's brother William invested in the bank, and persuaded Pine to step aside in 1891 in favor of James Stillman, Rockefeller's associate, to become president. William's son William married Stillman's daughter Elsie, his other son Percy married Stillman's daughter Isabel. James Stillman also had a London connection. His father, Don Carlos, had been a Rothschild agent in Brownsville, Texas, and a successful blockade runner during the Civil War. The National City Bank acquired several subsidiaries in New York. The National City Company later renamed the City Company and City Bank Farmers Trust Company. The dominance of the Morgan Gunlop financial power in New York is shown by a Dow Jones report in the New York Times February 11, 1928, that of total offerings of bonds in 1927, J.P. Morgan was first with $502,590,000. National City Company was second with $435,616,000. Goonloeb was third with $423,988,000. On July 3, 1929, the New York Times noted that Charles E. Peabody had joined the boards of National City Company and Citibank Farmers Trust. On August 4, 1932, the New York Times stated that National City Bank would issue its own currency against U.S. bonds carrying the circulatory power under the new Federal Home Loan Bank Act, which empowered National City Bank to issue up to $124 million in currency. The National City Bank had now become a bank of issue, a function formerly reserved to central banks. On June 8, 1933, James H. Perkins, CHMN National City Bank, announced the National City Company would change its name to City Company of New York. On November 21, 1933, the National City Bank listed 31 affiliates, including Citibank Farmers Trust, City Company of New York, City Company of Massachusetts, 44 Wall Street Company, and Cuban Sugar Plantations Incorporated on March 3, 1934. The New York Times announced that National City Bank would sell the National Bank of Haiti, a wholly owned subsidiary, on April 29, 1934. The Times also noted that National City Bank had organized United Aircraft February 2, 1934, and that its subsidiary, Citibank Farmers Trust, had celebrated its 112th anniversary on February 28, 1929. On June 27, 1934, the City Company of New York was designated German bond scrip agent in the U.S. On May 22, 1933, City Company of New York announced its merger with Brown Brothers Harriman, with Joseph Ripley as chairman of the board. The company went through several name changes as Brown Harriman Company Harriman Ripley, and is now Brown Brothers Harriman once more. On March 4, 1934, General Billy Mitchell, addressing the Foreign Policy Association, stated that National City Bank and its affiliates control aviation in this country. Alan W. Dulles, introduced as a specialist in international affairs, announced the profits of international munitions makers were unconscionable. On March 2, 1955, National City Bank announced it would purchase the stock of First National Bank for $165 million, $550 a share. In the 1929 boom, First National sold for $8,600 a share. Some market analysts believed the stock should have brought $750 a share in the 1955 sale, suggesting that the Baker family was no longer able to protect its interests. The resulting Citibank became the largest bank in the U.S., with a controlling interest in the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. National City Bank had been in Hong Kong for 80 years. It is a $90 million Citibank centered there. In 1983, 4% of its annual profits came from the Hong Kong operation, which is the center of the world's drug trade. Besides its controlling interest in the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, the Rothschilds had developed important financial interests in other parts of the United States. The House Banking and Currency Committee Report May 1976, International Banking, p. 60, identify the Rothschild Five Arrows Group and its present five branches, N.M. Rothschild & Sons Limited London, Bank Rothschild, France, Bank Lambert, Belgium, Newcourt Securities, New York Pearson, Holdering and Company Amsterdam. These five were combined in a single bank, Rothschild Intercontinental Bank Limited. The House staff report discloses that Rothschild Intercontinental Bank Limited has three principal American subsidiaries: National City Bank of Cleveland, First City National Bank of Houston, First City Bancorp, and Seattle First National Bank. These Rothschild subsidiaries were ranked in 1983 as follows: First Citibank of Houston, 23rd in size in U.S. $17 billion assets, National City Corporation of Cleveland, 48th largest in U.S. $6.5 billion assets. National City Corporation of Cleveland has exercised a dominant role in Midwestern industry and politics for many years. First Citibank dominates Texas oil and heavy industry as well as Texas politics. In 1900, Cleveland was the home of Marcus Alonso Hanna, known as Mark, the legendary political boss of the Republican Party. He twice nominated and elected an Ohio congressman, William McKinley, to the presidency of the U.S. He initiated the checkoff system by which banks and corporations were required to make regular political contributions. Hanna founded two companies, M.A. Hanna Company and Hanna Mining Company, which acquired large steel and iron holdings. In 1953, President Eisenhower named George Humphrey Secretary of the Treasury. Humphrey, president of M.A. Hanna Company, was also CHMN National Steel Company, recently acquired by Nippon Koken, a Japanese concern, director of Sun Life Assurance Company Rothschild, Industrial Rayon Corporation, the world's largest manufacturer of auto tire cord, LL. Strauss of Kuhn, Loeb Company controlled the firm. Harry Burt Jr. was also a director. Humphrey was also a director of the National City Bank of Cleveland. Other directors of this bank were C.T. Foster, CHMN Standard Oil of Ohio, J.A. Green, CHMN Ohio Telephone Company LL. White, CHMN Chicago and St. Louis Y.R.A. Weaver, CHMN Ferro Corporation J.B. Ward, President Dressograph Company H.B. Klein, President Industrial Rayon Corporation, and William McAfee, Director Standard Oil of Ohio. National City Bank of Cleveland now has $6.5 billion assets, 8,171 employees, and 17 companies. It recently purchased the $500 million Revenues Bank, Bank Ohio. In 1978, George Humphrey's son, Gilbert W. was CHMN Hanna Mining Company Director, National City Bank of Cleveland, Sun Life Assurance, National Steel, Massey Ferguson, General Reinsurance, and St. John Del Rey Mining Company M.A. Hanna Company, the holding company, was liquidated in 1965, and its $700 million assets distributed to its stockholders. The National City Bank of Cleveland's influence was not limited to the Hanna and Humphrey families. As the Ohio connection of the House of Rothschild, it guided the careers of two of the nation's best-known families, the Tafts and the Rockefellers. The bank financed the Taft family's activities in politics and business, the Taft Broadcasting Company, and other firms. John D. Rockefeller's success began when he obtained the backing of the National City Bank of Cleveland to finance his takeover of his competitors in the oil business. Because J.P. Morgan and Kuhn, Loeb Company controlled 95% of all railway mileage in the U.S. In the latter half of the 19th century, they offered Rockefeller special rebates on shipping oil through his holding company, South Improvement Company. This enabled him to undersell and ruin his competitors. One of them was a Mr. Darble, whose daughter, Ida Darble, later wrote the first expose of Standard Oil and was termed a muckraker by Theodore Roosevelt, a term which promptly went into the language. The entire Rockefeller empire was financed by the Rothschilds. When Lincoln Steffens became a Wall Street reporter, he interviewed both J.P. Morgan and John D. Rockefeller on several occasions. He soon realized that these gentlemen, powerful though they were mere front men. He noted that no one ever seems to ask the question, who is behind the Morgans and the Rockefellers? Apostrophe, no one else ever asked the question, nor did anyone answer it. Steffens knew the money for their operations was coming from someone else, but never managed to trace it. In February 1930, one of the few articles on the Rothschilds ever to appear in an American magazine appeared in Fortune, which stated, "On only one important point did the Rothschilds guess wrong. They never would have anything to do with the U.S. of America." Imagination falters at what the Rothschilds might be today if they had spent on the infant industries of this country one half the sums they poured into Imperial Austria. The Fortune writer did not know then and probably never knew that the Rothschilds have always controlled the Morgan and Rockefeller operations, as well as the foundations set up by these frontmen to control the people of the United States. During the past quarter of a century, many writers have published alarming exposes of the Rockefellers and their control of the U.S. through the Council on Foreign Relations. In 1950, the New York Times carried a small notice on an inside page that L.L. Strauss, a partner of Kuhn, Loeb Company, had been appointed financial advisor to the Rockefeller brothers. In short, all their investments must be approved by a partner of Kuhn, Loeb Company. It has always been thus, beginning with Jacob Zeef. Strauss held the position from 1950 to 1953, when it passed to J. Richardson Dilth. Dilth, who married Elizabeth Cushing, was a partner of Kuhn, Loeb Company from 1946 to 1958, when he became director of finances for the entire Rockefeller family, presiding over all their accounts on the 56th floor of Rockefeller Center. He held the position until 1981. He is now chairman of the board of Rockefeller Center, director of International Basic Economy Corporation Chrysler, R.H. Macy, Colonial Williamsburg and Rockefeller University. The National City Bank of Cleveland continues to dominate Midwestern industry and politics. For many years, its primary law firm has been Jones, Dess, Revis and Pogue of Cleveland. The Washington Post announced December 19, 1983 that this law firm was spending $5 million for office space in Washington to house a staff of 60 lawyers, making this Cleveland law firm one of the most potent lobbying groups in Washington. Hanna Mining Company, despite relatively modest revenues of $333 million, exercises an important role, as shown by its board of directors, including such distinguished names as Herbert Hoover Jr. Under Secretary of State under Eisenhower and Dulles, Stephen D. Bechtel, CHMN of Bechtel Group and Director of J.P. Morgan Company K.L. Island of Brown Brothers Harriman, George F. Bennett, Treasurer of Harvard University, and Nathan W. Pearson, Financial Manager of the Mellon Family. Despite the Hollywood image of red-faced Texas oil millionaires driving new Cadillacs, the Texas oil industry has for years been dominated by the London Rothschilds through the billion-dollar First City National Bank of Houston, and its 57 subsidiary Texas banks. Chairman of First City is James Anderson Elkins Jr., who is a director of Hill Samuel Company of London, one of the 17 merchant banks chartered by the Bank of England. His father was chairman of First City, and founded the Texas law firm of Vinson and Elkins, the primary law firm of First City Bank. This firm dominated national politics through its most well-known partner, John B. Connolly, who achieved a reputation as kingmaker in Texas politics. He began as administrative assistant to Congressman Lyndon B. Johnson in 1949, then became attorney for the oil millionaire Sid Richardson and Perry Bass, 1952-61, Secretary of the Navy 1961, Governor of Texas 1963-69, Secretary of the Treasury 1971-72. He was wounded in the Kennedy assassination in Dallas. He is now trustee of the Andrew Mellon Foundation, serves on the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, and the Advisory Committee on Reforming the International Monetary System. He advised Nixon on devaluing the dollar and going off the gold standard in 1971. He is now Director of Superior Oil, and Falcon Bridge Nickel Mines Limited. James Anderson Elkins is also director of Freeport Minerals, whose directors include some of the leading names in American business. CHMN of Freeport is Benno H. Schmidt, managing director of J.H. Whitney Company. Schmidt, who married into the wealthy Fleischman family, New Yorker Magazine etc., graduated from Harvard Law in 1941, became general counselor of the War Production Board in Washington 1941-42, and headed the Foreign Liquidation Commission 1945-46, which disposed of billions of dollars worth of property. He is also director of CBS, and Schlumberger, the huge oil field service firm who began business in 1928 when it was awarded its first contract by the Soviet Union. It is said to have important Anglo-Swiss intelligence connections. Other directors of Freeport Minerals are William McSney Martin Jr., chairman of the Federal Reserve Board 1951-1970, now director of J.P. Morgan U.S. Steel, Eli Lilly, General Foods, Royal Dutch Shell, IBM, American Express, Riggs National Bank, and Scandinavian Securities, the Wallenberg firm, Donald S. Perkins, of Morgan Guaranty Trust, Time Magazine, John B. Madden, partner Brown Brothers Harriman, Godfrey S. Rockefeller, Norborn Barclay Jr. Director Uniroyal, and Anglo Energy Limited. Other directors of First City Bank Corporation include Anne Armstrong, U.S. Ambassador to Britain 1976-77, co-CHMN Reagan Bush Campaign 1980, Director of General Foods, General Motors, Trustee Hoover Institution, Guggenheim Foundation, Atlantic Council, Council on Foreign Relations, Halliburton Company. George R. Brown, director of Halliburton, he founded that huge contracting firm, Brown & Root, which financed Lyndon B. Johnson's political campaigns, subsequently receiving billion-dollar contracts to construct naval bases and airfields in Vietnam, which are now being used by the Soviet Navy and Air Force. Brown married into the Pratt family, founded Texas Eastern, an oil firm, and is director of it, TWA, and the Brown Foundation. The Brown-Johnson Association began in 1940, when Johnson secured a lucrative contract for Brown & Root to build a large naval base at Corpus Christi, Texas. It was said then that any course chosen by Johnson would be paved by money from Brown & Root. J. Evers Haley pointed out that Brown & Root prospered on government contracts after Johnson helped them and rapidly became a worldwide operation. In 1940, the Internal Revenue Service found that large contributions given to Johnson by Brown & Root and its subsidiary, Victoria Gravel Company, as much as $100,000 each, were taken by Brown & Root as tax deductions. Haley states, Brown and Root were in control of Texas politics, that L.B. Johnson was in control of IRS, that records had been burned at IRS to get Brown off the hook in 1954. Johnson and Connolly then picked up a government plant for a small sum which became a giant wartime contractor, the Sid Richardson Carbon Plant at Odessa, Texas, in which Mrs. Lyndon B. Johnson had a 1/4 interest. In 1955, Johnson suffered a major heart attack on his way to George Brown's palatial Middleburg VA estate. As mentioned, Brown is a director of Halliburton, whose primary law firm is also Vinson and Elkins. In 1981, Halliburton had $8.3 billion revenues, 110,398 employees, and daily monitors most U.S. oil wells. In addition to George Brown and Anne Armstrong, directors of Halliburton include Lord Polwart of Scotland, who is Governor of the Bank of Scotland, Director of Canadian Pacific, Sun Life Assurance Limited, and Brown and Root UK, which interlocks with George Wimpey Limited, the largest construction firm in England, through Brown and Root Wimpey Highland Fabricators. Lord Polwart, Henry Hepburn Scott, is a descendant of James Hepburn, Earl of Bothwell, who was married to Mary, Queen of Scots. The first Baron Polwart, 1641-1724, was Sir Patrick Hume, 1st Earl of Marchmont, and William of Orange's closest advisor. He accompanied William in 1688 on his voyage to take possession of the throne of England, and became his privy councillor, in which office he advised William to grant the charter of the Bank of England. He became a peer of Scotland 1689, Lord Chancellor of Scotland 1696-1702, and Earl of Marchmont 1697. He passed the Act of Succession on to the House of Hanover, and was reappointed by King George I. John Pickens Harbin, President of Hawley Burton, is a director of City Cop. Another director of Hawley Burton is William E. Simon, Secretary of the Treasury 1973-77. He is a director of City Cop, City Bank, and United Technologies. As director of City Bank, he interlocks with Lord Aldington of London, Toby Lowe, who is also director of SI, a bank and chairman of Sun Life Assurance, the keystone of the Rothschild fortune. Lord Aldington is chairman of Grindley's Bank, London, director of General Electric Limited, Lloyds Bank, United Power Limited and National Discount Corporation. During a national oil crisis, government officials complained they could not obtain any records from oil companies on production and reserves, yet Hawley Burton received this information on a daily basis. As director of United Technologies, William Simon again interlocks with Citibank, the only corporation which has four officers on the board of directors of Citibank: Harry Gray, Churn of United Technologies, Simon, William I. Spencer, who is president of Citibank, and Darwin E. Attner Smith, CHMN of Kimberly Clark. Other directors of United Technologies are Robert F. D., CHMN and CEO of the Smith Klein drug firm, T. Mitchell Ford, General Counsel CIA 1952-55, now CHMN of the $1.8 billion Emart Corporation and Director of Travelers Insurance, Richard S. Smith, Exec. Vice President National Steel, was with First National Bank New York 1952-62, and Treasurer of MA. Hanna Company 1962-63, and Director of Hartford Fire Insurance, and Hartford Accident and Indemnity, Charles W. Duncan, Jr. Dep. Seconds Defense, 1977-79, Seconds Department of Energy 1979-81, CHMN Coca-Cola International, CHMN Coca-Cola Europe, Director Humble Oil Company Melvin C. Holm, President and CEO Carrier Corporation Director New York Telephone, Mutual of New York SKF Industries, Antonia Chandler Hayes, wife of Abram Hayes, who was law clerk to Felix Frankfurter, later joined Covington and Burling, Washington 1952-55, wrote the Democratic Nat. Platform 1960, Legal Advisor Seconds of State 1961-64, Director of Foreign Policy Democratic Nat. Committee 1972, Jacqueline Wexler, President Webster College 1965-69, President Hunter College since 1969, leader of the feminist movement, and Robert L. Sproul, with the Department Defense 1963-65, President University of Rochester since 1970, lecturer at NATO, director of Xerox, General Motors, President Terry Dawson. Other directors of First Citibank Corporation are John Diesel, president of Tenneco, which interlocks with the George Bush oil firm, Zapata Oil Corporation, whose CHMN John McKinn is a director of Tenneco, Randall Meyer, President Exxon, M.A. Wright, former CHMN Exxon 1966-76, now CHMN Cameron Iron Works. Other directors of Halliburton Corporation include James W. Glanville, former PTNR. Lehman Brothers and Lazard Free Rears, was with Humble Oil 1945-59, Lehman Brothers 1959-78, had been with Lazard Free Rears since 1978, and is director of International Mining and Chemical Company. Other directors of Lazard Free Rears include its senior partner, Michel David Neal, head of the Paris House of Lazard Free Rears, Donald C. Cook, Seconds Financial Examiner 1935-45, Director Office of Alien Property Custodian for Department of Justice, 1946-47, Commissioner Seconds 1949-53, and is now Director of ABC, Amirada Hess, CHMN of the Board American Electric Power and Director of General Dynamics, the defense-oriented firm, Felix Rohatyn, Horn in Austria, came to U.S. 1942, married Jeanette Striet, daughter of Clarence Striet, head of union. Now with England, Rohatyn joined Lazard Free Rears in 1948, is director of Schlumberger, McCarr, American Motors, Owens, Illinois, Engelhardt Mining and Chemical, Pfizer, IT, and Rockefeller Brothers Fund. He is CHMN Municipal Assistance Corporation, which bailed New York City out of its approaching bankruptcy, Frank C. Zarb asked. To President of the U.S. 1974-77, Administrator Federal Energy Administration 1974-77, now Director of Philbro Corporation and Engelhard Mining and Chemical, and the Energy Fund. The Houston-Cleveland axis interlocks with many political figures, including W. Michael Blumenthal, Secretary of the Treasury 1977-79, who interlocks with the axis through Chemical Bank, Equitable Life and the Rockefeller Foundation, Robert B. Anderson, Secretary of Treasury 1957-61. Partner of the law firm of Struck, Struck & Leven, which administers the Warburg family finances, and interlocks with this group through Equitable Life, Eaton Pan Am, G. William Miller, CHMN Federal Reserve Board of Governors 1978-79, Secretary of the Treasury 1979-81, interlocks with this group through Textron and First City Bank Corporation. Was CHMN of U.S.U.S.S.R. Trade and Economic Council, now Director of Federated Department Stores, whose directors include three directors of Chase Manhattan Bank and interlocks with Citibank and Kuhn Loeb Company. The political power of this Rothschild-controlled axis was demonstrated by the ease with which they financed the campaigns of two governors of supposedly conservative southern states, John D. Rockefeller Riv. In West Virginia, and Charles Robb, son-in-law of Lyndon B. Johnson, in Virginia, heir to the Connolly Brown and Root First City Bancorp political clout. Chapter 4, The Buisness of America, Part 2. The May 1976 staff rept of the House Banking and Currency Committee noted another Rothschild affiliate, P.60. The Rothschild banks are affiliated with manufacturers Hanover of London, in which they hold 20% interest, a merchant bank, and manufacturers Hanover Trust of New York. Manufacturers Hanover recently bought the giant CIT Financial Corporation for $1.6 billion in October, 1983. Despite his reputed wealth, the elder J.P. Morgan did not leave one of the great American fortunes when he died in 1913. It was first estimated at $75 million, then $50, and finally disclosed there were only $19 million of securities in the entire estate, of which $7 million was owed to the art dealer Duveen. J.P. Morgan Jr. known to a very few intimates as Jack, was embarrassed to find he had to sell off many of his father's art treasures to pay the debts of the estate. Most of the huge sums handled by J.P. Morgan went directly to the Rothschilds. In 1905, the New York Times noted in its obituary of Baron Alphonse de Rothschild that he possessed some $60 million in American securities, although the Rothschilds, according to most financial authorities, had never been active in American finance. Lincoln Steffens noted, "Senator Aldrich is a great man to me, not personally, but as leader of the Senate. He, Aldrich, bows to J.P. Morgan. The other day J.P. Morgan came to Washington, and he and I and Aldrich had a conference. And I noticed how he, Morgan, addressed himself to me, not to Aldrich. Morgan talked to me, while I talked to Aldrich, who talked to Morgan. Morgan's partner, George W. Perkins, worked furiously to obtain Theodore Roosevelt's nomination as McKinley's running mate. During Roosevelt's presidency, his closest advisor was George W. Perkins. Despite Roosevelt's nickname of Trust Buster, he protected Morgan's interests throughout his term of office. His successor, William Howard Taft, was opposed to Morgan, and introduced antitrust legislation to control two Morgan trusts, International Harvester and U.S. Steel. Perkins then created the Progressive Party in 1912 to split the party and defeat Taft. J.P. Morgan's apex of power was attained in the Panic of 1907, when he assumed control of Wall Street. Oakley Thorne, president of the Trust Company of America, a victim of the panic, testified before a congressional committee that his bank had been subjected to only moderate withdrawals, that he had not applied for help, and that it was Morgan's sore point statement alone that had caused the run on his bank. That Morgan interests took advantage of the unsettled conditions during the autumn of 1907 to precipitate the panic, guiding it shrewdly as it progressed so that it would kill off rival banks and consolidate the preeminence of the banks within the Morgan orbit. Morgan's financial power came from control of the enormous cash flow of the nation's biggest life insurance companies. He gained control of Mutual Life, New York Life, Metropolitan Life, and with George F. Baker and James Stillman, bought controlling interest in Equitable from Thomas Fortune Ryan, who had acquired it from the Hyde family. Hyde originally set Equitable up while acting as a front for Jacob Siff and James Speier. On June 7, 1933, Nation noted J.P. Morgan is generally regarded as the most prominent banker in the world. Paul Y. Anderson mentioned in this article that testimony before the Senate Banking Committee showed that Morgan and his partners, including Thomas W. Lamont and D.T. Stotesbury, paid no federal income tax in 1931-32, the partners paid a total of $48,000 in 1930. Anderson remarked, "Is there any mystery as to why the Marines were dispatched against Haiti, San Domingo, and Nicaragua when those countries defaulted, or threatened to default, on the debt payments to American banks?" It has been shown that the Morgan firm had a certain selected list of clients to whom it sold stock at figures substantially under market prices. In the case of the Allegheny Corporation, these fair haired boys got the stock at 20, when the market was 35. Anderson pointed out that these fortunate few could have sold the stock immediately for almost double what they had paid. Among the recipients of these Morgan favors, he listed Senator McAdoo, Justice Owen Roberts, Secretary Woodin, Owen D. Young, and John J. Raskob. In Nation, June 21, 1933, Anderson continued, "When Fort Sumter was fired on, gold began to leave the country. The man who later said 'Don't sell America short' then took a flyer on the short side of America. He borrowed $2 million in gold coins and shipped it to London. This was really a blow behind the lines. Then he went to the gold room to watch the effect. there was a scramble for gold to pay commitments abroad, and this patriotic American with 2 million in Eagles in London sold at his own price. In March, 1929, perhaps in preparation for the coming storm, to Morgan Banks merged, the National Bank of Commerce, which, according to the New York Times, had important foreign connections, and Guaranty Trust, forming a $2 billion institution. On February 26, 1929, the New York Times noted, "The Guaranty Trust has long been known as one of the Morgan Group. The National Bank of Commerce has also been identified with Morgan interests." J.P. Morgan's longtime associate, George Fisher Baker, was one of the founders of First National Bank, purchasing 30 shares in 1863 for $3,000. He also was cashier, and later became president. Sheridan E. Logan's book, George F. Baker and His Bank, privately printed, 1981, noted that a European syndicate headed by N.M. Rothschild was represented in New York by August Belmont and First National Bank to refund the government debt. Baker wrote a letter August 29, 1876. "I have to advise you that our negotiations with the Treasury Department resulted in a contract between Messrs. N.M. Rothschild and Sons and others and the Secretary of the Treasury for the purpose of $40 million of U.S. 4% of 1,891, with an option on the remainder, $260 million. In this contract the bank participated to the extent of 10%, $4 million. Logan also states that in 1901 Baker sold to J.P. Morgan $23 million stock in Central Railroad of New Jersey. The mutual confidence and respect which developed between Mr. Baker and Mr. Morgan cemented their increasingly close relationship, and the First National Bank became more and more the unswerving ally and valuable source of mobile funds for the work of J.P. Morgan and Company. In 1901, Baker increased the stock of First National Bank from $500,000 to $10 million by a 1,900% stock dividend. He organized First Security Company, a holding company, with this dividend. During the 1929 boom, Baker's personal fortune reached the $500 million mark. His son, George Jr., pleaded with him to pay of the $29 million owed on stocks in First Security's $80 million portfolio. Baker, then 89 years old, had not been informed of the planned credit contraction, possibly because the insiders feared he might gossip about it. He continued to refuse to sell any stocks. The crash of 1929 reduced his fortune to $200 million. When he died in 1931, the estate was appraised at $73 million. His son, George Jr., inherited $30 million. His health had been shattered by the strain of working with his father during the disparate days of 1929, and he died of a heart attack in Honolulu, aged 59. His son, George F. E. I. was found shot at Horseshoe Plantation, Florida in 1977. George E. I.'s son, Grenville, was found shot at Tallahassee, Florida in 1949, at age 33. George Jr.'s daughter, Edith Brevoort Baker, married Jacob Siff's grandson, John Mortimer Siff, in 1939, uniting two of America's largest fortunes. George Baker I.'s daughter Florence had married Howard Blake's son George in 1891, member of one of England's oldest families. Their granddaughter Priscilla married Angier Biddle Duke in 1937, and second, Alan A. Ryan Jr. in 1941, a relative of the Delanos. In 1935, General Smedley D. Butler wrote in the November issue of Common Sense of his Marine career, "I helped make Mexico and especially Tampico safe for American oil interests in 1914. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National City Bank boys to collect revenues in. I helped purify Nicaragua for the international banking house of Brown Brothers in 1909-12. In China in 1927 I helped see to it that Standard Oil went its way unmolested. In 1899 J.P. Morgan floated the first important foreign loan on behalf of the Mexican government. In 1901 he lent $50 million to the British government to fight the Boer War. But it was mainly into the countries of Spanish America that American capital found its way. Butler continued his revelations in the December 1935 issue. In 1910, 6 months after the Nicaraguan Revolution which ousted President Zelaya, his successor, Dr. Madras, grew cold towards the Nicaraguan investments of Brown Brothers and Seligman Company, another revolution immediately occurred. Butler mentions the Latin American activities of Brown Brothers, now Brown Brothers Harriman, a firm little known to most Americans. In 1801, a linen auctioneer from Belfast, Alexander Brown, established a banking house, Alexander Brown & Company, in the slave trading port of Baltimore. It is now the oldest banking house in the U.S. Its English branch, Brown Shipley, also became influential, its most well-known member being Lord Montagu Norman, Governor of the Bank of England for many years, 1907-44, longer than any other man in history. Current biography 1940, noted, there is an informal understanding that a director of Brown Shipley should be on the board of the Bank of England, and Norman was elected to it in 1907. In expanding Rothschild investments in U.S. railroads, Kuhn, Loeb Company found a useful agent in E.H. Harriman. A young man on the make, Harriman married the daughter of the president of a small New York railroad, and soon looked for more worlds to conquer. George Redmond writes in Financial Giants of America, he, Harriman, early won the confidence of Kuhn, Loeb Company, and established relations which later became most advantageous to both. Kuhn, Loeb financed the Union Pacific takeover by Harriman. H.J. Eckenrode notes in E.H. Harriman, in his takeover of UP, Harriman had behind him tremendous financial force, not only Kuhn, Loeb Company with funds from Frankfurt and Berlin, but the National City Bank, the greatest source of cash in the country. Harriman employed Judge Robert Scott Lovett as general counsel for Union Pacific. When Harriman and Otto Kahn were summoned by the Eck in 1897, Lovett advised them to refuse to answer all questions about their stock operations. In 1908, the Supreme Court upheld their refusal to talk. The records of this case, S.C. No. 133 U.S. v. U.P.R.R., later disappeared from the Library of Congress. In 1911, the Equitable Life Insurance Building, which contained all the records of the U.P.R.R., burned, destroying all UP papers to that date. Lovett's son, Robert Abercrombie Lovett, married Adele Brown, daughter of a partner of Brown Brothers, and became partner in 1926. He was special asked. Seconds of War 1940-45, Under Secretary of State, 1947-49, Dep. Secretary of Defense 1950-51, Secretary of Defense 1951-53. It was Lovett who took the then Secretary of Defense James Forrestal, of Dillon Reed Company, to Fisher's Island to persuade him to change his stand against U.S. Middle Eastern policies. Forrestal refused, and was placed in a mental ward at the National Institute of Health, where he fell out of the window. Lovett then replaced him as Secretary of Defense. Brown Brothers backed the B&O Steamship Line in 1887, and went into joint venture with J&W Seligman Company on a number of South American loans. In 1915, Brown Brothers combined with J.P. Morgan to float a series of Latin American loans, which in many instances were followed by revolutions in the respective countries. In The Nation, June 7, 1922, Oswald Garrison Villard noted, the Republic of Brown Brothers with J. and W. Seligman had reduced Haiti, Santo Domingo, and Nicaragua to the status of colonies with ruinous loans. Most of the loans were repaid in 1924. In 1931, W. Averill Harriman, son of E. H. Harriman, merged his banking house, W. A. Harriman and Company with Brown Brothers to form the present firm of Brown Brothers Harriman. In 1933, Brown Brothers Harriman backed the expansion of CBS, in which they have maintained a large position. The Brown Brothers firm occupied offices on the corner of Wall Street and Hanover, which had been occupied by J.L. and J.S. Joseph Company, the American representatives of the Rothschilds. Joseph's went broke in the panic of 1837, having been cut loose by the Rothschilds, who were now operating through Auguste Belmont and George Peabody and Company. W. Averill Harriman brought to the new firm his vice president, Prescott Sheldon Bush, who had been with him since 1926. Bush became chairman of the board of Pennsylvania Water and Power Company, director U.S. Rubber, Pan Am, CBS, Dresser MFG Company, Vanadium, U.S. Guarantee, Prudential Insurance and partner Brown Brothers Harriman. He was CHMN National War Fund 1943-44 and CHMN USO. His son George Bush is now Vice President of the U.S. George Herbert Walker, grandfather of George Bush, who was named after him, became President of W.A. Harriman Company in 1928, now Brown Brothers Harriman. He was director of Belgian American Coke Ovens Corporation, CHMN, Habenshaw Cable Corporation, CHMN, International Great Northern Railway, director CertainTeed Products, American Shipping and Commerce Corporation, American International Corporation, Cuba Railway Company, Pennsylvania Coal and Coke. He was the donor of the Walker Cup, the prestigious golf trophy, and president of the U.S. Golf Association. In 1925, he financed the building of Madison Square Garden. His son, George H. Walker Jr., became CHMN Walker Bush Oil Corporation and Zapata Petroleum, George Bush's firm, Salesian Holdings, with W.A. Harriman Siff Investing Corporation, Westmoreland Coal Company and West Indies Sugar Company. He is a trustee of Yale. George H. Walker E. merged the firm of G.H. Walker Company with Lead and Company and White and Weld in 1974. He is now a senior vice president of White and Weld. Harriman was the go-between of Churchill and Roosevelt's World War II alliance. The two leaders did not know or particularly like each other. Each of them conferred with W. Averill Harriman about how to talk to the other, and carefully followed his advice. W.A. Harriman served as U.S. ambassador at large during World War II, principally in Moscow with Stalin. His brother E. Roland was president of the American Red Cross. Robert A. Lovett was Secretary of Defense. Harriman was related by marriage to Wild Bill Donovan, founder of the OSS. Brown Brothers has always maintained close relations with British firms. James Brown, partner from 1935-50, was director Northern Assurance of London, Sun Insurance, President British Empire Club and National Bank of Nicaragua. Thatcher M. Brown, another partner, was director of Manchester Land Company, National Bank of Nicaragua, chairman of the board of Liverpool and London Insurance Company Limited, Globe Indemnity Company, Royal Insurance, British and Foreign Marine Insurance Limited, American London and Empire Company, Ocean Accident and Guarantee of London, and Thames and Mersey Marine Insurance Company. The New York Times noted May 29, 1928. Dr. Rudolf Rosler, representative of the New York banking house of Brown Brothers, said Germany for a number of years to come would be a borrowing nation. Brown Brothers had loaned the city of Berlin $15 million on 6% 30 bonds, and Mr. Rosler, who comp.ited details of the transaction, said that it was the biggest loan to a city in Europe since 1914. The New York Times later noted, word was received here yesterday by J. Henry Schroeder, Banking Corporation representative in the U.S. for Captain Alfred Loewenstein, that a corporation organized by the Belgian capitalist and French associates, whom it has offered the public in Paris, had been oversubscribed 25 times. The holding company for artificial silk shares was offered at $117.50 and promptly went to $200. This good news was somewhat paled by the Times report that a syndicate had been formed to handle this stock since Captain Alfred Loewenstein, whose reported death through a fall from an airplane in the English Channel July 4th has been surrounded by mystery. J. Henry Schroeder is to purchase $25 million of bonds of International Holding and Investment Corporation through Albert Pam, of J. Henry Schroeder London, and Albert Svarvasi, head of British Foreign and Colonial Corporation British Investing Company. The July 5, 1928 New York Times headlined, Captain Loewenstein Falls from Plane. Known as Mystery Man. Alfred Loewenstein was known as a Croesus. The Mystery Man of Europe, the successor to Sir Basil Zaharoff as a man of mystery, in European finance. The pilot informed the authorities that while the plane was crossing the sea, Captain Loewenstein, wishing to go to the washroom, opened the wrong door and fell out. His valet and two stenographers, as well as the pilot and mechanic of the plane, were present, but did not notice what happened. The story added that Loewenstein owned 8 villas in Biarritz, an estate in Lancashire, a castle in Brussels, and a townhouse in London. Informed observers believed it was Zaharoff himself who dethroned the pretender to his title as Mystery Man of Europe. Loewenstein had become involved in a desperate struggle with Zaharoff and his associate, Dreyfus Klapp, to control the artificial silk industry in Europe. After Loewenstein's accident, his two associates in this struggle also died mysteriously. Erich had an automobile accident on a deserted road, with no witnesses. Loewenstein's third associate, Prince Radziwill, was poisoned by a woman friend, according to a French journal, L'Acropole. W. Averill Harriman was 78 when his wife died. A year later, Catherine Mile Graham, publisher of the Washington Post, invited him to a party to meet Pam Churchill, daughter of Lord Digby, an English horse fancier. She had been married to Randolph Churchill, and was mother of the present Winston Churchill. She then married into the first family of Hollywood, producer Leland Haywood, formerly married to actress Margaret Sullivan. In Haywire, her autobiography, Brooke Haywood describes her stepmother as a cold-blooded gold digger who made off with her mother's jewels. Pam dated Ilida Rothschild before deciding to marry Harriman. They are now the dominant figures in the Democratic Party. Harriman has given $15 million to the Russian Institute at Columbia, now the Harriman Institute. Another prominent banking house is the firm of Dillon Reed. Clarence Dillon, 1882-1979, was born in San Antonio, Texas, son of Samuel and Bertha Lepowski or Lepowitz. He graduated from Harvard in 1905, married Dan Douglas of Milwaukee, whose father owned Milwaukee Machine and Dual Company. They went abroad from 1908 to 1910. Their son, C. Douglas Dillon, was born in Switzerland in 1909. In 1912, Dillon met William A. Reed, founder of a well-known Wall Street bond brokerage, through a Harvard classmate. They became partners. Reed died suddenly in 1916, and Dillon bought control of the firm. During World War I, Dillon served as Bernard Baruch's right-hand man at the War Industries Board. In 1915, Dillon had set up American and Foreign Securities Corporation to finance the French government's purchases of munitions in the U.S. His right-hand man at Dillon Reed was James A. Forrestal, who later died while serving as Secretary of Defense. Dillon Reed played a crucial role in rearming Hitler during the preparation for World War II. In 1957, Fortune magazine listed Clarence Dillon as one of the richest men in the U.S. $150-200 million. By normal growth rates, his son C. Douglas Dillon should be worth over $1 billion, but nobody knows. C. Douglas Dillon worked with John Foster Dulles on the Dewey campaigns, and served as Under Secretary of State, helping Bechtel Corporation obtain its first large Saudi Arabian contracts, which later became a $135 billion operation. Dillon was ambassador to France 1953-57, later became Secretary of the Treasury. He was chairman of the Rockefeller Foundation from 1971-75, then chairman of the Brookings Institution. To organize his estate, he sold Dillon Reed to the Bechtel Corporation. He is considered to be one of the 10 wealthiest men in the U.S. and one of the 3 most powerful. Second to the Rothschilds, the Warburgs were considered the most important international banking family of the 19th and 20th centuries. In 1798, 2 sons of Marcus Gumprecht Warburg, Moses Marcus and Gerson W., founded M.M. Warburg Company in Hamburg. They were descendants of Simon von Kassel, a 16th century moneylender and pawnbroker. They were also direct descendants of Abraham del Banco, largest banker in Venice. When they moved north, they took the name of Warburg, after Kassel settled in this Westphalian town. In 1814, the Warburgs became one of the first affiliates of N.M. Rothschild of London. They were related to the leading banking families of Europe, the Rosenbergs of Kiev, the Gunsbergs in St. Petersburg, the Oppenheims and Goldschmidts in Germany. Moritz Warburg was apprenticed to the Rothschilds in Italy and Paris, and later married Charlotte Oppenheim, whose family were diamond merchants in Frankfurt. They had 5 sons, known as the 5 Hamburgers. The oldest, Abai, founded the Warburg Institute. Max financed the German struggle in World War I and later, the Nazi regime. Dr. Fritz Warburg was German commercial attaché in Stockholm during World War I. Paul and Felix emigrated to America and joined the firm of Kuhn, Loeb and Company with Jacob Siff, who had been born in the Rothschild house in Frankfurt. Paul wrote the Federal Reserve Act and saw it through Congress. He represented the U.S. at the Versailles Peace Conference, while his brother Max represented German interests. The memoirs of Max Warburg state, "The Kaiser thumped the table violently and shouted, 'Must you always be right, question?' but then listened carefully to Max's view of financial matters." M.M. Warburg Company closed during World War II but reopened in 1970. George Sokolsky noted in We Jews, "Even in Hitler Germany the firm of Max Warburg was exempted from persecution." Max left for the U.S. in 1939. Unhampered by supposed restrictions on Jews. The U.S. Naval Secret Service Report December 2, 1918 noted, "Paul Warburg, German, nationalized U.S. citizen 1911, decorated B.V. Kaiser, handled large sums furnished by German bankers for Lenin and Trotsky. Has brother Max, who is director of espionage system of Germany. In partnership with Walter Teagle of Standard Oil, Paul Warburg organized the International Die Trust, IG, Farben and Agfa Ansco Film Trust. At the second annual convention of the American Acceptance Council, December 2, 1920, President Paul Warburg said, "It is a great satisfaction to report that during the year under review it was possible for the American Acceptance Council to further develop and strengthen its relations with the Federal Reserve System." He did not add that as vice chairman of the Federal Reserve Board from 1914-18, he had organized the Federal Reserve System, or that he served as president of the Federal Advisory Council from 1918-27. Which actually formulated policy for the board. He was director of Union Pacific, B&ORRS, National Railways of Mexico, Western Union, Wells Fargo, American Ag Chemical, Agfa Ansco, Westinghouse, Warburg Banks in Amsterdam, London and Hamburg, and chairman of the board of International Acceptance Bank. His brother Felix was chief financial banker of the Zionist Organization of America, Palestine Economic Corporation, National Railways of Mexico, Prussian Life Insurance of Berlin, and many other companies. Felix's son Edward M.M. Warburg succeeded General Donovan as coordinator of information in 1941 and later served as special political advisor to General Eisenhower at Chef, London during World War II. His other son Frederick was Herbert Lehman's right-hand man in organizing the Lehman Corporation and was later known as the Foreign Minister of Kuhn, low because of his many contacts around the world. He retired as a country gentleman at his estate Snake Hill, Middleburg, VA. His partner, Louis L. Strauss, had a magnificent estate nearby at Brandy Station, site of the Civil War engagement which was the largest cavalry battle in U.S. history. Department of Commerce figures show that Kuhn, Loeb controlled 64% of all railroad mileage in the U.S. in 1900, which dropped to a mere 41% by 1939. In 1900, Kuhn, Loeb and J.P. Morgan, representing the Rothschilds, controlled 93% of all railway mileage in the U.S. Speyer & Company controlled New York real estate and South American minerals, Seligman & Company sugar, public utilities, and Latin American loans, August Belmont, the New York subway system, Lazard Free Ears, gold and silver, specializing in international gold movements. U.S. News May 14, 1984 listed Who Runs America. The first 10 included Weinberger and Schultz of Bechtel Corporation. The second 10 included Sulzberger of the New York Times, Vice President Bush, David Rockefeller. The third 10 included Katharine Graham and Henry Kissinger. Former President Gerald Ford was not listed. He is now director of GK Technologies, a $1.19 billion firm with large defense contracts. Other leading defense firms are United Technologies, Skim Corporation, whose chairman Malcolm Baldridge is now Secretary of Commerce. Directors include Daniel Pomeroy Davison of J.P. Morgan Bank and President U.S. Trust Olin Corporation $1.85 billion, and General Dynamics, controlled by the Crown family of Chicago. When Texaco swallowed the $12 billion Getty Oil Corporation after its founder died, it showed the financial power of the London connection. Directors of Texaco included Willard C. Butcher, former CHMN of Chase Manhattan, Earl of Granard, Forbes, the first baronet had reduced Sligo for William E., and grandson of Ogden Mills, Secretary of Treasury U.S. 1932-33, Thomas H. Mora, CHMN Joint CHFS of Staff 1970-74, Director Fairchild Bunkeramo, Robert V. Rusa, Director Brookings Institution, Trilateral Commission. The Rothschild Houston Cleveland Axis brought off one of its greatest coups when its agent John Connolly, then Secretary of the Treasury, persuaded Nixon to abandon the gold standard. The New York Times headlined, August 16, 1971, Sever's link between dollar and gold. President Nixon announced tonight that henceforth the U.S. would cease to convert foreign-held dollars into gold, unilaterally changing the 25-year-old international monetary system. The president said he was taking the action to stop the attacks of foreign monetary speculators against the dollar. The change in the world monetary system brought about by the presidential decision to cease converting foreign-held dollars into gold is entirely uncertain. That was the word used by Secretary Treasury John B. Connolly. Mr. Connolly said he did not know what would happen. The Times noted that advice to impose some controls has been given the president from such sources as David Rockefeller, CHMN of the $23 billion Chase Manhattan Corporation and the Organization for Economic Development, a group representing 22 nations. The Times editorially stated, "We unhesitatingly applaud the boldness with which the president has moved on all economic fronts. an admiration for the completeness with which the president has junked the do-nothing approach that immobilized the country and sapped the national will. On 17 August 1971, The Times quoted Paul Volcker, Undersecretary of the Treasury, who, when asked if other currencies would rise in relation to the dollar, replied, "I think we are in no position to object." With the story was a photo of Volcker conferring with banking officials in London, with the caption, "Undersecretary Paul A. Volcker conferred with leading European financial officials here today on President Nixon's new policy to meet the dollar crisis. He hinted broadly that the US would be happy if other countries let their currencies float in the exchange markets. Their value would presumably rise in relation to the dollar." Mr. Volcker said he had found a very good understanding in his meeting. But at the end of a confusing day in European ministries and banks, few thought they could see a clear way out of the immediate monetary chaos caused by Mr. Nixon's moves. Advance knowledge of such a far-reaching change in the monetary system would be worth billions of dollars.